amazing and soon to be more amazing, because I hope you'll all sign up. So thanks, Nettie. My name's Lou Harvey. I'm at the University of Leeds in the UK. And I convene with my colleagues, Jess Bradley, if you just give a wave, Jess, to Jessica, and Emily as well. We jointly convene this ILA Research Network in Creative Inquiry and Applied Linguistics. So ILA is the international umbrella organisation for applied linguistics, and they host a number of research networks, and we applied for a research network in this area because we felt that there's lots of people doing creative-based work now who are associated with language and linguistics research in some way, and we got it, and it's great, and we've got nearly 100 members, I think.
Wow.
Over 100 from about sort of 20 countries. I think all the continents are represented. So it's big and it's getting bigger. You can find us on our JISC mail address. This is we have meetings. I mean, I'm putting this meeting under the aegis of the ILA network. And we have discussions on email, and we share information about creative-based work on email and so on. So you can sign up to the email address there and the email list. Or you can have a look at our website, our WordPress website and blog, where you can read about some of the things we've done. And we are, you know, it's an applied linguistics association, so you know there are a lot of applied linguist researchers in it, but there are also arts practitioners and people who don't kind of identify as linguists or practitioners, but are kind of interested in the sort of work that might happen where language and arts comes together. So if you're interested in any way about this sort of creative work and the kind of things we've been talking about, please come and have a look at the website and please feel free to sign up. So what do we do? This is just our few key points, but this isn't at all exhaustive. I mean, it's very inclusive. But broadly, we look at how people are using arts-based and arts-informed methods and artifacts for understanding and researching communication. In all sorts of domains. Also, applied linguistic methods for researching and understanding creative practice. And the role of arts and creative practice in public and educational engagement with applied linguistics research. So how can we engage other people with the kind of research that happens in universities and outside universities as well. And the role of creative inquiry in generating new ways of thinking about the relationship between language, knowledge, and the world. So it's very much bringing together and trying to develop and build upon exactly the kinds of things that Sari and Kate and other people have been talking about over these 2 days. Please do chip in, Emily and Jess, if there's anything I forget to say. So I should say as well, this work is happening, again, it's very broad, all sorts of contexts. But there's quite a lot of people working in the sorts of context that we've been talking about. So around migration, social cohesion, belonging and inclusion, education and engagement quite broadly. So I'll just very quickly go through some of the projects we've been doing. This is a recent project that I did with a theatre company that was a public education project to talk to settled communities about how we might think about settled communities' role in integration and belonging and how settled people communicate with new arrivals. This is a project by Christina. Where's Christina? I should have said lots of members of the network are in the room. We've got Christina, Nettie, Sari, James. So, you know, there's a few of us here already. Christina's work in Catalonia, working in this case, secondary school children working with a rapper to create multilingual rap, multilingual hip-hop. A project called, oh, I'm sorry, it's cut off the title there. This is Migration and Settlement, yeah, that was led by Jess Bradley and James Simpson based in Leeds. And this was working with refugees and asylum seekers using different arts methods to explore and try and better understand new ways of thinking about home and belonging and settlement. This is, I think...
Ljubljana. Is it Ljubljana?
Oh, yes, it is. It's Ljubljana, yes. This is Jess's fieldwork. Jess's fieldwork in Ljubljana from her PhD, which was using applied and sort of applied linguistic lens, particularly a translanguaging lens, to understand storytelling and creative practice and making practices in street theatre. And this is some colour. Is this from the...
This is
artist Louise Atkinson, who's done a lot of work, collaborative work with us in Leeds. And this was part of the landscape project, I think, Jess. Yeah, so this was an engagement project to engage young people, sort of secondary school age young people, to become ethnographers of their own linguistic landscapes. Some work that Emily Moore has done in Barcelona. At the top there is digital storytelling, I think, is that right, with young people? And then actually this lower project is based in Leeds. This is a poetry slam with the Leeds young authors that Emily, I think, was part of. Were you part of the judging panel for that? And researching at the same time, yeah. So that's just, there's lots and lots of stuff going on. That's just to give you a little flavour of the very different things, the different modes that we're working in. At the moment as well, we have a collaboration with BAAL, the British Association for Applied Linguistics, in partnership with Curator Space and Multilingual Matters. And BAAL are looking for applied linguists and visual artists to submit visual representations of multilingualism as part of an international competition. Yes.
Just to say that BAAL is coming to Manchester Metropolitan University next year, and I will also be giving a keynote which is going to basically say that Lou is right. So that's going to be great, because you're also going to be Lou is right.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, we've brought the Creative Inquiry to BAAL for a couple of years, but I think that I hope this will really expand that circle.
I'll talk to the team about how we can do that with you.
Excellent.
I'm on the organising committee.
That would be great. Amazingly. That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah.
But yes. Thank you, Jess. Yeah, so that's open now. If you're interested in submitting something for that or just finding out more about it, then there's a link. The link is on the slides, which I think we should be able to share somehow, Nettie. But this link is also on our Creative Inquiry WordPress website. So do please go and have a look at that. And please sign up and join the network.
So
it would be really nice to see you there.
We'll be able to post for the people from Newcastle University. You can post the link to the Creative Inquiry and the link to the competition on our reclass website.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Nettie. Thank you. Awesome. So, but if anyone would like to come and talk to me or Jess or Emily about what we do and the kind of work that's going on, if you're just interested in finding out more about it, then please come and talk to us. We'll be here all afternoon today. Thank you.
Thanks.
session. This came about stemming from the knowledge sharing because we've been grappling in multimodality and we've been grappling with discourse and privacy and protection and what is considered bad. Can you take it from the comment section of this, of YouTube, etc. So all these, with the new world changes, everybody's struggling. We're all struggling. And this was a perfect opportunity to bring together professors and researchers who work in the field, in various areas of the field, who have experience and who are also struggling. So we know that we're doing it together. And it's going to be a discussion amongst all of us. How do we interpret the rules? What do we think? You know, it's not just going to be, this is not a lecture to tell you how you should conduct your research. It's actually the opposite. It's meant to be an interactive. If you have questions, because I know there's some master's students here, you have questions. This is the place, space, and these are the people to ask these questions. Okay. We're going to start.
Sure, if that's okay.
Yeah, oh, did your
microphones are.
Oh, right. Oh, I just made that.
Should I use it?
Probably. It'll go into the left. Is it on?
Sorry about this. It doesn't seem to be recognizing my device. It takes a while. Apologies. As long as it's uploading, I'm Sefa Leppänen. I am a professor of English here. I have conducted research on social media since the early 2000s. I originally started my work on fan fiction years ago when it was not called social media at all. It was something else. In those days, in the early 2000s, there was very little discussion of ethics and about data protection either. These were very much issues that emerged alongside with the research that people were, you know, increasingly engaging with. Still nothing? What I'm going to tell you, it's a kind of a starting point or springboard, hopefully, for the discussion. These are some of the questions that I've been thinking of, and the material that I'm going to show you very, very briefly just reflects the kind of ongoing process that I'm myself engaging in at the moment in trying to figure out, for instance, for my students, what to tell them if they're interested in doing research on social media. What are the issues that they should be paying attention to, and what are the concerns, generally speaking, in this particular field of research? That said, I think many of the questions that are specific to social media are more general, and I'm sure there are, you know, points of similarity between the concerns of anyone doing sociolinguistic, ethnographic, discourse analytic work involving human beings, and communication, language use, interaction involving human beings. So I hope there are points that are more general than just relating to the kind of work that I've been doing with social media discourse data. That said, I think there are a couple of other people here in the audience who are familiar with social media data. I know Marco, for instance, you have been talking about these issues in public as well. So if you want to comment on anything I said, please feel free. And then Sara, anyway, we just recently published an article. It was a long-term project, took years to complete, and it emerged in electronic form a couple of years ago, a year ago or so?
Last year,
right. And the print version came out recently.
Yeah.
And at that point, after GDPR, you know, some of the issues with the data suddenly sort of became very problematic. And Sara had a long discussion with the university lawyer about these issues, and it was very, very difficult to come to terms with her view, which was very categorical and narrow and dogmatic in terms of whether or not we should be working even on these kinds of data. So really, really thorny issues that you have to encounter at the moment. Let's see if this works. What do I do if I don't receive my device?
Go to the file folder and click on that, and then
there's
Is this on the mic?
Yeah, it's on.
Okay, good. So yeah, so very quickly, this won't take too long. So I think I already told you that I have a long history, relatively speaking, in research on social media, and have been looking at different kinds of social media data as well. Textual, interactive, most recently multimodal. So I've done a whole lot of work on YouTube videos, for instance, and the kinds of issues that I've been looking at are mentioned here: linguistic heterogeneity, identities, identification, gender, recontextualization of multimodal popular cultural material, translocality, superdiversity, digital labor most recently. So various kinds of issues that I've been interested in. Right. And just as a reminder, I mean, what we mean by social media is a complex thing in itself, that it can actually involve different kinds of media and different kinds of platforms as well, which are, discursively speaking, and in terms of the kind of communication and interaction they involve, can be very, very different from one another. Right, but you Nettie, you wanted us to talk about the challenges deriving from GDPR.
Yeah, with the privacy issues.
Right, okay. Well, maybe just a few points that I've sort of been thinking about myself, and I've collected this material from various sources, and like I said, I mean, one of the problems relating to the use of social media data is, in light of GDPR, the fact that GDPR is extremely multi-voiced. So it was the outcome of a political negotiation process involving different kinds of actors and different kinds of interests. And that definitely shows in the wordings of the statute. Which means, and another way of putting this is that it is incredibly difficult to interpret the intention in a very clear way, what is actually being said about data protection with respect to research. And one of the reasons is, of course, that the same statute, in a way, has to be applicable to companies and corporations as well. Right. Now, the difficult issue here is that, in terms of the kind of work that we do, is that most social media data is defined as personally identifiable data. So there are personal data which allows direct identification, names, even aliases, photos, videos of human subjects. And then, to make it even more complicated, there are data which allows identification of human subjects indirectly. So the IP address is one. Voice, if you're dealing with voice and image, of course. I mean, voice also as an indirect means of figuring out who this person might be. Searchable verbatim citations of somebody's discourse, or references to place of residence. So, for instance, tracing, Googling bits of discourse that you come across in social media can actually be a way of identifying, possibly, who the real persons behind the data are. So, as you can see, it's incredibly, incredibly thorny questions that derive from this fact that social media data often is the kind of data on the basis of which you can actually figure out who these people are, who have produced discourse on social media.
Maybe one more general point, and I'm going to say a few more specific points about the GDPR itself. And this kind of view comes from the researchers in this area, and they are saying that the ethical use of social media is actually a debated area. And one reason for this is that the whole social media technologies, platforms, are complex and evolving constantly. And that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to provide very strict and categorical rules of what then applies in terms of their use as research data. And that means also that researchers themselves have to be extremely aware of, you know, what sort of constraints there are to their activities, what sort of regulations there are at different levels, internationally as in GDPR, nationally in terms of laws, in terms of the kinds of regulations and terms and conditions set by the platforms from which they gather their data and so on, how they apply to their particular studies. So we need to be very well informed, and we need to educate ourselves in order to be able to come up with good arguments and good rationale for why is it okay for me to do this particular piece of research, and have a good response, Sarah, to the lawyer, for instance, who categorically said that no, this doesn't work, and who even asked, I mean, should you be doing this research in the first place? Right. I can share these transparencies if you're interested, but I'd like to emphasize that this is ongoing work. I don't have all the answers yet. Right. There's a very, very good source of information that I've used myself is a chapter in a book by Townsend and Wallace entitled Social Media Research, A Guide to Ethics. And it sort of provides you with some of the tools with which and through which you can, you know, do the reasoning yourself. I mean, is it okay for me to proceed this way rather than, you know, do something else? So I really recommend this chapter. It's very, very good. Right, I'm going to skip those and then a few more specific points about GDPR. Right, that I think I already said. Social media data is potentially identifiable even if you pseudonymize your data. That I already explained. But then, interestingly enough, and the GDPR basically says to everyone, all the researchers doing whatever research, that your processing of data or your research needs to be lawful. It needs to have a legal basis. And to be more specific, it says that all processing of personal data needs to be lawful, and this can be achieved by demonstrating one of the six lawful purposes. One. So one of these criteria is enough to justify that your research is actually lawful according to the statute. And look at them. So the processing of personal data, research, in other words, is for legitimate interest pursued by the data controller. What that means again, yes, right? Processing has been consented by the data subject. So that's very clear. You have sought consent from your subjects, a very specific consent which gives you rights to process, analyze, store, archive your data. Processing is of vital interest to the data subject. Right. So it's for his or her benefit, in a way. There are grounds for arguing this. Processing is in the interest of the public. Now, that's an interesting criterion, isn't it? And I know, I mean, somebody just told me that they had a discussion with the lawyer of another Finnish university, the Aalto University. And was it you, Sigurd, who told me this?
I
Oh, right, somebody else. Right. And this lawyer in the Aalto Technological University, I think it's a technological, I can't remember. Anyway, Aalto University, he said that this is actually the criterion that researchers can use to justify that their work is actually lawful in the spirit of the statute, that the research that we do is in the interest of the public. So already, I mean, if you read these criteria, I mean, this should be enough, provided that all the other measures that you take in your research are actually ethical. Right. Processing is required for the performance of a contract. That's another lawful reason for conducting research. Processing is required to comply with a legal obligation. Right. I think this is a kind of a comforting message, in a way. If you read these specifications of what makes your processing of data involving human subjects lawful. But of course, you need to come up with your own arguments. Nevertheless, I mean, in what way does my work serve the interest of the public or the common good? Right. And, you know, other points that you should bear in mind, of course, national law. The law of personal data in Finland dates back to 1999. It has been in the process of revision, and it should have been passed. The new version should have been passed this autumn, but it's still in the making, isn't it? It hasn't been passed yet. It is completed in Finland. Right. Okay. Right. Right. And then the terms and conditions of the platforms. What do they actually say about your right to use the data extracted from their platforms for research purposes? And this is an important point because the terms and conditions in different media, social media, digital media, in different platforms vary a lot. And they keep changing. So you need to be very, very careful about this particular aspect of your use of research data. What are the actual terms and conditions and that are in place at the moment when you're doing research? I mean, there are all sorts of tricky questions here as well. What if they change and you're still in the middle of your work? What then?
Oh, do they have an answer for that? Like, is it a certain percentage if you started 50% or 50%?
I don't have a good answer to that. Marco, what would you say? Right.
I seriously doubt the legal ramifications of this kind of one-sided contracts. But I'm not a lawyer.
Right.
I really love to have a chat once with our university's lawyer about this. Because I do know universities, for example, University of Helsinki, where they have taken a bit more proactive steps.
Yes.
But one university's idea is that the lawyers then protect the scholars.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right. Yes. Yes, indeed. I agree completely. Maybe it's time for me to stop and let the other speakers continue. Do you want to go, Yevali?
I don't really have much to say.
We
I mean,
saw
some of the examples that we were talking about. Before.
Yes, I mean,
really
well, one of the sort of thoughts that I had, you know, listening to Sirpa's presentation is that a lot of these issues are not just for digital research and digital environments, but they're, you know, very pertinent for any kind of research with human subjects. So, Yes, we're just sort of chatting with Vicky and saying, you know, we have a lawyer, a law office at Goldsmiths, but we've never really thought about, you know, you guys here seem to be talking a lot with your lawyers. We don't, you know, I've never, I don't even know where they are located, let alone. So, I mean, you know, in terms of research, you know, and talking about research ethics, this is not something that we've got any guidance from our university, unless I've missed something, I don't know.
The time when we've discussed this before is more in the dissemination of research data and how that's publicised on social media platforms, but also kind of in other ways. And that's sometimes when we've had to get like legal advice about how that research can be disseminated. And we've had a few cases that we've had to deal with just recently of those kinds of things.
Can you give an example then with one of the cases?
Well, that one's an ongoing one. and that's more about personal data. And so it's different than research data. It's a typical thing of somebody putting on Facebook something that they shouldn't do and those kinds of issues. So it's those crossovers between the personal and the researcher, I think, sometimes.
Well, what I was going to do, I had a slightly different approach. I think... I don't know whether this is helpful, but I work a lot, as I said before, with artists. And one of the artists I work with, Steve Poole, says to me, Kate, the university ethics aren't ethics. They're just ways of the university protecting themselves. And I think I completely respect the presentation. I think it's really helpful for all of us. But I also think we need to think about, if we're doing co-produced work, what co-produced ethics frameworks could look like. So I was just going to show a couple of examples. And one is the Imagine Project, which basically drew on an original project which was set up by the National Coordinating Centre for Public Engagement, which was called Community-Based Participatory Research, A Guide to Ethical Principles and Practice. Now, this was done, obviously, before the laws came in, but I think one of the things to think about is whose ethics is it for? Is it for the universities, or in terms of co-production, is it actually about community research? And this was what this was about. So basically, what we looked at, and this was a group in Durham, but I've used this a lot, is this idea of what happens in participatory research when there's a difference between... The difference between the idea of participants and the subject-object thing isn't there. We are all researchers. And so these guidelines kind of give some ideas as to what to do, and they help us navigate that. So we kind of looked at these. So mutual respect, equality, inclusion, democratic participation, making a difference in collective action. And we drew on these... And we, in the Imagine Project, we set up a set of ethical principles together first. And we set up an ethical agreement with our community partners. And we all did that together. And then in the second stage, we devised our own ethics forms. Now,
can I ask a question?
Yeah? So the first stage was informed consent with the whole team to do the research ethics. And the second was informed consent with the people we were working with. But the forms were devised by the research participants. So an example of what I'm doing at the moment on the Odd Project is that I gave the children, this is a project called Feeling Odd in Education, a copy of our ethics forms and our consent forms and asked them to discuss them in groups. And one of the things it said on the form is, I am happy to be written about in an article. I then described what articles were. At the end of the description, quite a lot of the children said, I don't want to be in one of those, and said no. Now, I think that that was actually a really interesting moment, because the notion of the children saying no, I think, is very unfamiliar to a lot of researchers. But actually, it was a really interesting moment in our research, because what then happened was we had a day of researching with the children, and they were co-researching what it was to be odd. And at the end of the day, we said, can we film you? And they again said no, great. But then they gave me signed copies of writing they'd done that they said could be in the project. Now, this is a way of thinking about ethics that's totally different from a university structure. But luckily, MMU have allowed us to do a process-led model of ethics. And I think what that does imply is this notion of consent and informed consent and children giving consent needs to be taken seriously. And for the Taking Yourself Seriously project, for example, we took a year to figure out who was going to be in that booklet that we did and whose names were going to be done. So I guess part of it is to argue for a process. I'm talking mainly to the MA students in the room, actually. This idea of a process model of ethics. So this idea really is, we had a two-stage framework. So we had the ethical framework, then we had a two-stage process, and then we got individual ethical approval. And some outputs had to be agreed as a stage-by-stage process. We also had intense media scrutiny. A lot of the communities we'd worked in had been on Channel 4 programmes like Benefit Street, and they didn't want to be, particularly the girls, didn't want to be at all image-based. So that's why we only have a booklet for our project. We don't have a website. So I think these things are really useful to kind of, and this is the website of our project, just so that you can see it. But I guess that's just from our perspective. It's like thinking of ethics through the eyes of young people rather than through the university lawyer's eyes. Is that all right? But I can leave you with these resources because they are quite helpful. And it is a different take. But I guess what I've learned is community participants get quite distressed at universities. I'm quite serious about this, actually, saying the word ethics, because they interpret ethics as a moral code and not as the systems that we have in our universities. They think that means you're being ethical. They actually, and we don't read that word at the same way. We have to stop doing that. And we have to think, well, if I was a normal punter and someone said ethics to me, I think it would be about being morally good, not about a form. So I think we do need to really think about that. And it does make it harder because we have to basically think about two things. One is the issues you've raised by data protection, which I agree, I have my locked filing cabinet and I have my password-protected laptop, and I am obviously obsessed with not keeping data that's not consent. But at the same time, the children in my study have to have a voice in that process. So,
no, there. If you're working with, you know, marginalized groups, or if they don't have literacy skills, or they speak a different language, or whatever, consent is an ethics. Those words sound so scary. And, you know, if you're working with refugees, you say, this is an ethical form you're going to sign. They're thinking, oh, you're going to take my data and give it to the police.
Yeah, so, and signing a form is an absolutely impossible thing for many refugees to do.
Totally agree with you that we have to, it's not, it shouldn't be from, we have to be ethical, but we have to change the way we discuss ethics to our participants.
One of the great things about ethics, and the reason I'm really into it, is that it provides the participants the opportunity to say no. If we can see it as that, and we were told in Rotherham particularly we should encourage our participants to say no, that's a really good way of starting with it. It's a break on us. It's saying you can't necessarily do what you want. And it decreases our power, which I think is good. So you learn to learn from participants as to what actually is realistically what they would like. And that takes ages. It takes about a year to figure that out. But ethics should be about people having the opportunity to say no, because otherwise what's the point? So it's got to be about the word no. I'm just about to write an article on this.
Can I ask one really quick question? Yeah. Were the participants, did they volunteer to be part of the project?
So we had a community research team of about six people who came in at the beginning and were paid quite a lot, like about £6,000 each, like Zainab and Marcus. And, so. And they did the ethics with me. And then the participants were the people, like the young people we worked with on the Roma Heritage Futures project, and they worked specifically with Deborah. And Deborah navigated the ethics of the young people. It took about a year, I think, to do that. So the community researchers distributed the ethical forms. It took ages.
And the children have volunteered to be part of the project.
It's a complex thing. The Imagine project was huge. Yeah. So with each project, I mean, I know, so our bits, these are all our bits. I know that Deborah worked with a teaching assistant in her school on the this project, to see how many projects there are. So she worked with this group, and they came at lunchtime, I think. It was a lunch club. I mean, there were so many different projects, and they were run by, so Tasby, I know Calda, worked with a group of older women and younger women. All of these were completely led by community. So Zainab and Shaheen did their intergenerational projects. But they led them. That was the point. They were leading the projects. So they had to devise their own ethics forms for each project. It took a long, 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 long time. It's not easy. And luckily I had a project administrator, bless her, who logged it all. And when we had to put some of it into the UK Data Archive Service, which meant we had to have proper consents, particularly for the Park Hill project, that was UK Data Archives. So this project is, you can access the interviews because we got consent to put them into the public. It was a bit of a long haul. But I guess what I'm saying is believe in ethics. Don't go away and say, I won't do an empirical study because I'm too scared. But believe in it for its potential for thinking through issues like whose knowledge is it. The potential of ethics to open up a space, actually to give you your participants more say over the research. It's a way of involving participants in being able to decide if your project's what they want to be in. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, that's
the
floor's open, everybody.
I was thinking, when you are working collaboratively and really closely with participants, and we know that you can produce writing, and in some instances, so from my own experience, I try to write up something with co-researchers, in this instance, as teachers, and we don't necessarily always agree.
Oh, yeah.
So, of course, I aim for this.
This happens.
Multi-voiced, whatever, and it's not always working, but you know, the idea is there. But still, I do find that one thing is, yes, they did volunteer, yes, they did agree, but still there is an ethical question of how, in the end, the representation itself.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that's much more interesting than whether or not somebody has said, yes, that sounds really interesting, I want to be part of that. Or in the end, they say, no, I don't want to be part of that anymore. There are the two sort of options of opting in or out. But all of the gray area in between, where somebody is there and you have started on a journey together and you're working towards something that you thought was an agreed goal, an agreed target, but just like you're saying, you don't necessarily always understand the practitioners, they don't necessarily always understand the idea of the new project, and things move. And so how would you tackle those situations? What do you do when you...
Yeah, it's a brilliant question. I mean, the answer is partly this, that we have co-produced publications, which I've got examples of, and I've given Nettie the book that we co-produced together, which you might like to show. But the other answer is that I have also failed. So one of these projects, they disagreed with me. I'm trying to find the one. I don't know if it's here, actually. Oh, here it is, yeah. So this project, the group, the women's group, decided they didn't agree. We didn't agree, so we've never written this project up. And that was quite good for me because I was made to feel that I didn't necessarily have the answer. So we've never written that project up. Zainab Rasool has talked a little bit about it from her experience, but that was a two-year project every Thursday in a multilingual project in a library, but it was because the volunteers wanted their interpretations and we couldn't agree. And it was really complex as a story behind it. But it's really good that you raised that because I would like people to know that I don't always get it right. And that some pieces of research in communities with communities end up with a kind of failure. And that failure is sometimes pushed aside. But I think if we are going to do engaged research, we have to be honest and say sometimes things don't work out. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of letting go. Because the community that ran that, they said, we don't agree with what you and Zainab are saying. It was about safe spaces for women and girls and what are safe spaces for women and girls. And that was the debate. But we had different interpretations of that. So that's a really important question. But what I'd like to say is that ethics is the way that you know whether you've it does put a brake on things, because not knowing I haven't got permission is actually very good. I think it's good for those women. They've carried on, actually, by the way, they've carried on and they've done their own book. So they did their own book. And I feel like it was really, in a way, important to acknowledge that some things don't go well. And we told our funder as well, they were very supportive, because it was at a time when it was quite difficult in the UK around Muslim identities, and we could see, we had to just say there are two stories, there's multiple stories. So that was hard but good. It's still on the website, the project's still on the website actually, which is interesting. But we haven't written it up.
Yeah, that's really. We always just assume everything's successful.
No.
It's so easy.
No. I really want to do a project on failure, actually.
Yeah.
I think we've really learned from that experience. And you can see how many projects there were and how diverse the projects were. And they were really complex.
We'd like to open up the floor and ask about, and it doesn't have to be about co-production, it can be about social media or data collection or whatever, but open up the questions to everybody. So what do you guys want to ask or bring up?
To whom may I ask? Okay. Yeah. Well, I have a question that there might be not any specific answer for it. And a professor talking about ethical concerns once said that nothing is true, but everything is dependent. So my question is that, is it ethical to insist on having consents from the research participants? For example, I work with underage children, and I need consents from their parents. And for example, in my case, there is a boy that there's 1 year that I'm asking him that, did he take the fact sheet to the parents or did they sign it or anything? And he is not that he rejects to participate in my research, but he just neglects it. And sometimes I see myself like I'm insisting and I don't like it, but I know that he likes to do it, but he just neglects it. So is it ethical? How long can I continue this way? Or I just should give up and say that, okay, he won't be my participant.
Yeah, we've worked a lot in contexts where the children don't have parents or they're in local authority care, but also where it's difficult to access the parents. So what we tend to do is we do our ethical form in advance to have a parental figure like a youth worker or a teacher who can sign that bit of the form. So we've worked a lot with youth workers and teachers as loco parentis, because some of the children you can't reach the parents in the projects we've been in. So that's the way around it. We've got the teachers and the youth workers, but we write that in at the beginning of the form. And that's so mostly with over 12 people, with older children. I mean, with the older children, we think teenagers is a kind of complex space. Alison James has written about this, that actually teenagers, the access to parents is complex. So that's where we do it. I think with younger children, we would say parents, yeah. But these were children about 12, 13, 14. And sometimes it was really hard. And so we'd have the teachers would agree to be that in that role.
Do you have any way to contact us there? Like by email or something?
Yes, actually, I have not done it officially, but also the mainstream teacher has been asking him.
Okay.
Maybe he has lost it.
Yeah, that's most likely the case. It's like, oops, he doesn't want to admit.
Yeah. That's probably the.
And I know about his family. I mean, historically, I've heard about his family, but I know that he has parents and he lives in a household. But I was thinking, would it be ethical if Sora just have to give up?
I think you should.
Yeah, you need consent. You do need consent. Yeah,
you do need parental.
you know, as a young child, you should insist to get it.
Yeah.
Yes, he is interesting for my set. So.
So you can just ask him, so what's your parents' email address? And then just send it to the parent and go, by the way, I forgot, or he forgot, or, you know, yeah.
But now it's more than 1 year.
Consent after the fact. I think you still need to.
Give him another form.
Yeah. Like he's probably lost it or something.
Well, I have given so far two.
Oh, man.
I also imagine that it's like for children. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In very simple words, mm-hmm. I explain what I am doing. And for example, he has words to make.
Other questions like Petri, Sigrid, you guys want to bring up? Because I know you guys have very different issues, but.
It's not a question, but I just wanted to say in that case, if it's in Germany, I wouldn't even be allowed to ask the boy for the email address because I would need the consent of his parents to even send them an email. Because I'm in one class of my kids, I'm kind of, I don't know how this is called, I represent the parents. I'm a class rep. And as long as I don't get a written consent on paper by the parents, I can't even write an email to them if it's okay that I send emails to them. So that's the case in Germany.
So I guess it's not so uncommon to have a community after school events, for instance, where the parents don't actually show up at all, but the kids somehow go there by themselves. So it might I have faced situations where even the teachers have never practically met the parents, so all communication goes to the child. And then, of course, if even the teachers who organize the things, they don't have this direct communication with the parents for a researcher who is staying there for a less long period of time, it's impossible to establish communication with the parents. And there are also cultural issues in some cases that some parents, it would be somehow, well, they don't like to be connected. So that would be unethical to force this communication. So I would, in those cases, they kind of have given over their, they allow the child to go there and to participate. And thus, if those who organize it, and if there is, you are not doing medical research or anything like that. So I would say that then it's ethical to carry out the research and rely if the child is willing to participate and the teachers. So in those special cases, of course, this is, well, there are communities which don't operate in our Western ideology. And in those, I have been in similar situations when you don't have communication with the parents. So that doesn't mean you cannot do research, I would say, still. At least in the research kind of that we do, which is in the interest of the children. And it's not kind of that we are not doing medical tests or whatever on the children. So that would be a different story altogether. That's my personal opinion on this issue.
I don't know. For me, it is a bit strange to do research without asking parents first for permission. Regardless, this okay, this what we were talking about, all this social media. But I think, like, it is like, I don't know. even if we don't think about terms of what is ethics in front of law and all these things, I think it's ethical, of course, to ask parent for permission. So, like, I know it's just, I have just my PhD experience, but I asked permission from the institution, so I did it into kindergartens. And then, like, okay, in Slovenia we have also this, so that parents, they have, like, gatherings, for example, twice per year in the kindergarten when they all come. And it's like they talk about the issues, that what's going on in kindergarten. And then I presented the research to all the parents. I think it's, like, fair to present what you're going to do and what's your intentions, and to ask for consent forms. And then even if, okay, it was really small children, they were, like, 2 to 5 years old, but then even if parents consented, I think you have to be always, like, you have to be always watchful. Even if kids don't express verbally that they don't want to do, they might express it, like, with, like, if we are talking about multimodal ad in other ways, like silence or ignoring or whatever. So I think you always have to be cautious through the entire process on all these aspects. Like, sorry.
I kind of like to build on that as well, because we've worked with projects mainly with school children between the ages of 6 and 18, so working with a lot of school children, and we've always asked for parental permission when we're working particularly with all the children of that age group. But we've also, it's always been participatory research, and so they've always given their permission for their, we've used the names of the schools that are involved in the project, we've used the names of the teachers involved in the project, and we've used the names of the students because they're the filmmakers, and so their names appear at the end of the film. But as part of the consent, there's also kind of, do you allow your child to have their photograph taken, those kinds of things? And again, because of the communities we're working with, often they don't want that to happen. And so during the process of filmmaking, when we're out in schools and we're taking photographs and we're filming the process, then we always know exactly which children do not want to be filmed, or they sometimes do that even with body language as well, and so we're very careful. And those students, they're happy to have their names at the end of a film because they've created an animation or they've done something through pictures in that way, but they don't want to have a photograph shown. I think some of the work that we were discussing earlier shows that too.
Of course, hi, Marko Siitonen, University of Jyväskylä. Most of these examples now have dealt with what I would call clear-cut human subjects research. When we enter social media, things get much, much muddier very quickly. Let's say somebody has written something years ago on a public website, and a media scholar approaches it in a similar way as they would approach an opinion piece in a newspaper. Is it human subjects research in the traditional sense, according to which, you know, code of conduct and so forth? And I think this is one of the things which makes it sometimes really difficult. It may be impossible to obtain consent, for example, after a time. The number of people participating in producing the social reality that you are studying might be so large that it is quite simply impossible to obtain consent from everyone. Even if you would, it would not be the traditional kind, that is a signature somehow stored in a traditional way and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff there, but actually I think one of the things I have been mostly concerned with and sort of worried recently, and this is within the EU sphere, of course, is that ever since GDPR came a thing, whenever we talk about research ethics, we're not talking about research ethics, but we're talking about legal matters. And of course, this is, of course, nasty, because we as researchers like ethics, we want to discuss, and I usually, these are very fruitful discussions, but more often than not in recent weeks and months when I have talked with people about these things, it always sort of turns back to legal issues and legalities and this kind of stuff, and we're sort of waiting for the country specific clarifications to the EU. It's not a law, but it's whatever it is. Yeah, exactly. And we are sort of tackling with our lawyers and you know, people with whom we also did not used to have so much contact, I have to say. But suddenly we feel the need to do so. It's as if the whole conversation has been hijacked by a totally other body of people with their own interests and own sort of momentum, and we are just trying to struggle to not to get pulled under. And this is a bit of a shame, and I'm hoping that we can slowly get back to the really important issues, which is discussing the ethical conundrums. And Sigurd wants to continue.
Just one brief comment on that. Basically, reiterating what Marco just said, if you go to DMP Tuli, there is a special section which says ethics and legal compliance. And what we're talking about is not ethics, it's legal compliance. And ethics has to do with it, but basically, and this is what Marco said, it's something different. We're now talking issues of legal compliance when we talk about GDPR rather than ethics, which has to do with even politics. I mean, how do we articulate what's our voice? How do we relate to the other's voices? I mean, that's basically a political issue or an ethical issue, but something that's not in the whole GDPR picture.
Understanding very much sort of coming out now that they need to revise the kind of very strict and categorical policy they had in the beginning. And what's tragic about the situation is that there are so many young researchers, for instance, who don't really know what to think and what to make about the changing situation if the interpretations of these constraints are changing. So where are they? Where should they be? And how to make up their minds? And that's why I said it's very, very important in this, you know, changing landscape to educate yourselves. I mean, this is a very excellent, you know, opportunity, this particular situation, to become more educated about the issues and concerns and questions we have. But it also involves sort of reading the documentation very carefully, the GDPR statute, the national law, the terms and conditions of platforms, the ethical guidelines concerning the kind of research that you're doing, to be very well educated. And that I think is an, you know, increasingly important duty of ours as researchers. And I do hope, I mean, Marco, you may have more information about this than I do, but, you know, I hope that eventually in universities and in research institutes there will be a kind of dialogue between the legal representatives, lawyers, and the researchers. So I'm actually hoping for it that in this university at least there will be that opportunity. But if nothing like that happens in your where you're working, I mean, perhaps you should, you know, be proactive and push for that kind of dialogue to happen.
Do the master's students have any questions if they're working about the new rules and how it might affect your research? Do you want to ask? Just a question?
I don't think we have any research to do yet.
Thank you. So I'm, I guess, one of those young researchers that's really questioning if the direction my research is taking is legal, lawful. I am trying to look at a police interrogation that took place in the United States that is on YouTube. It's also a matter of public record within the U.S. Like, this interrogation was released by the police department, and if you would like to request it, you will get it, which I have done, but the process takes a long time. So I've been transcribing and doing my research, my preliminary research, on a YouTube video. I guess my main question would be, if I have to resort to... I've been in contact with this suspect's defense team, and they've promised to provide me with an official copy of the interrogation. So I'm hoping that that will circumvent a lot of these problems. But if in the end I have to use and resort to the YouTube video, is it okay if I anonymize and take out sort of any potentially identifying characteristics from the text? I mean, would I have a lawful basis for processing this data? If you don't mind.
Okay, so I'm not fully aware of the regulations in the US. I know for a fact that they are somewhat different from the regulations and constraints and, yes, from Europe. But one issue that we haven't talked about yet that much is the whole issue of what is public and what is private as data. Because lots of the data that get published on different kinds of social media are public in the sense that they are publicly available, meaning that you don't have to have a permission from anyone to be able to see or, you know, read or watch that data. In Europe, this situation is complicated by the fact that the GDPR doesn't recognize the fact that, you know, publicly available data is not constrained by the same statute as, you know, private data, data that for which you have to have permission or to access or consent from the subjects to use. So this whole issue again, I mean, what is private, what is public, and how are we entitled to use, process, do research on publicly available data is also a complicated one nowadays, at least in Europe. The situation in the US may be different, because in US I know, and Marco, again, you might know more about this than me, that they still have this what they call the fair use clause. So some public data is okay to use in the US under the condition that it conforms with the concept of fair use. So that's one issue that you should find out. I mean, does your work on this data qualify as fair use?
Well, so I've determined, and I'm not a lawyer by any stretch, but I've determined that yes, it does.
Yes.
So my question is, does that cover me within the EU? I mean, I'm doing my research in the EU, but you're American.
Right. So, right, your data is from the EU. Okay. Yes, okay. Yes. I think it's the US regulations that you should follow. But then again, when you try to publish that data, and if you're publishing it in a venue that is not US based, then you may end up with new sets of, you know, restrictions and demands from the publisher.
Let's say that this data was deriving from the EU. If I anonymize sufficiently the data, I mean, this case was somewhat high profile. But if I try to take out any identifying characteristics, I mean, would that be? Yes.
I think once you got permission from the defense team to use the data, I think that you're quite safe there.
Okay.
nothing can happen to you. Regarding the other question, can you just use, regarding the other question, the fact that it's published on YouTube, I think you have to take into consideration how did it get published on YouTube? I mean, there's a lot of things.
Well, I actually know the answer to that.
Uh-huh. Defense team posted. Defense team posted. Okay. Then I think you're quite safe. Yeah. But just the fact that something is on YouTube does not make it legal to use it. So, and then you have to look at how did it arrive on YouTube, and we discussed about this before. Apparently in the US there seems to be specific regulations for each state, different state, concerning what kind of legal materials are public or not. And you know, GDPR has a special regulation for information relating to criminal offenses. So there's something, in principle, you need consent from the data subject. So once you've got that from permission from the defense team, I think you are on the safe side. I mean, no, I don't think you are on the safe side. You are on the safe side.
can I continue? Sorry. Yeah. I think also, and that would be the legal point of view, and I would agree. It is, and also, like, in this case, the publicity, sort of, we have to always evaluate, indeed, we have to think about, is this really public? What does it mean if it is public? How is it viewed? In this case, yeah, it's a public record, which is publicly presented by the people who had the actual sort of legal reason for doing so and so forth. I wouldn't think about that. But then we enter the ethical questions, of course, and I think that's the more, again, the more important and interesting one here, which is how will you present the data? How will you, you know, especially if it is a high-profile case, is there possible harm? What will happen to the data if you anonymize it? Is it even possible to anonymize it in such a way that and if not, I mean, that's not always possible. It's not always possible to anonymize data. It's not always necessary. But you still have to think about the sort of try to play the long game and think about what if? What if I do this? What then? What if I do that? Then what? You know, and I think, and you can never fully guess that, but anyway.
Yes, it is.
Okay, by the way,
he was convicted, he's in jail.
Mm-hmm. And one question that you should take into consideration here, which is not a legal compliance issue, but a real ethical issue, is why is the defense team, if you were getting permission from the defense team, why are they giving permission to you? What are they, is, might there be an agenda? There might be a kind of idea on their part that you might fit into their agenda.
Mm-hmm. That I'm not, my research interest is not in his innocence or guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've told them that I'm not like an advocate for him or anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But still, you know, there might be some tacit instrumentalization on their behalf going on. This is just one thing to consider, you know. It's definitely not.
Surprise, desperate.
In a second, just a small point. There's also the issue, not just when the data is public, but also what are the cases when the research, or the truth, if you're in your research striving for true and reliable knowledge and you're a responsible researcher, when does that override an individual's right to privacy? And there are cases like that. So if you can argue very strongly that it's in the public interest, regardless of privacy issues, to do the research that you're doing, and without the data that includes personal information or personal data, that research would not be possible, then that's another way of making your case about your study being both ethical and lawful.
Yes, that was a very good point, and completely in accordance with the GDPR as well.
But I wanted to say something about anonymization and pseudonymization, which we haven't talked about yet as well, but it came up in your question as well. So it's very important to be aware of the implications of this distinction. I mean, what does pseudonymization entail and what does anonymization entail? Pseudonymization means that you basically make sure that the research subject you are investigating becomes unrecognizable and untraceable, unidentifiable. For instance, by using a pseudonym, replacing, you know, his or her place of residence, any references to a physical location or information like that. But anonymization, which is often also sort of set as a requirement to ensure that you protect the privacy and identity of your research subjects, would actually be a very problematic thing for anyone doing language or communication research or ethnographic research, for instance, because it would actually mean that we modify the data in a way that it is no longer authentic. And then that would add up to a falsification of our data. And then we wouldn't be investigating the kind of issues that really exist. Yeah. So that's one really important concern as well, that, you know, you may hear these recommendations that you need to anonymize your data, but then be very wary what is required from you. If you're looking at the actual forms of how people talk, write, communicate, interact.
Just a quick question about that. Do you mean that if the that's a difficult word, making the participants anonymous, do you mean that it can become inauthentic? Do you mean that like deleting those kind of features such as gender and age, or do you think that has influence on it, the data becoming inauthentic? Okay, yeah, thanks.
Again, that was a very good question.
I suppose one of the things that I always think is how can research...
It's a bit like Vicky's point. How can research benefit participants? So a lot of our work has been done in communities where there isn't a high university involvement by young people. So what we do is we encourage young people to put being in the research project on their CVs, but also a lot of the young people do the exhibitions themselves and write themselves in the books, and actually that's really good for their CV. So if they were stripped of identity, that would be really unhelpful, because they actually, their being involved in the project has helped them access university. And I've got a couple of my participants who now actually do have university places, want to read Spanish, because of being in the projects, because they actually are very engaging experiences. But actually that young person is anonymous, but another isn't. And one of the poets in the poetry book that I showed, she isn't, and she's really proud of her poem, and she would be really upset if she was. It would be taking away her identity as a creative writer. So I think we need to think, well, what kind of research are we doing? And these kind of dialogic research projects really need to recognise the contribution of young people as co-researchers, but also as creative artists. So there's a kind of serious question here about what kind of violence we're doing if we anonymise. And I have actually been in a research project myself when I was anonymised. I was absolutely furious because I was misrepresented. So, and I tell you, and I never could go to the conference again where the person talked about me because I was too upset. So that, it really is bad if you're anonymised and then talked about. And I've got Steve's been anonymized. I can't remember his pseudonym. I think mine was Juliet. But it's not ethical. You still recognize yourself. It doesn't feel nice. You've just been turned into a pseudonym. So, I mean, I have to say, I think your point, Vicky, about giving the children the opportunity to have their names is really good.
Thank you. If I may contribute to this, because I'm from a different clime, I want to say that when you have a material online, it's available to everybody. And so the question of pseudonymization might not be a very serious matter, because the names are already there, and it's just like trying to pseudonymize names in novels and drama materials. You know, the names are there. It is different from the kind of data I use as a medical pragmatic scholar, which will not be available to everybody. And of course, we are talking about the sensitivity of the issues here. You are talking about someone who is going to die. You are talking about someone who has very terrible ailments. And so you have to pseudonymize so that you cannot trace him. But where the material is online, the question of hiding the names will not be a serious matter. But I think I agree with everybody who has spoken in respect of the usability of the material, provided the right steps are followed. Thank you.
Yes, I had a small question. One thing I think which we do need more discussion about, and this is something SIRPA raised, is the fact that GDPR does not recognize the public sphere. I mean, what is private, what is public? And the fact, the way I understand it, the mere fact that something is publicly available, publicly say that something that someone publishes something on social media, is not in itself sufficient ground for using it as data. And you know, I can buy into that. It's not because you publish something on Facebook and you haven't read the small print, or you don't know properly how Facebook works, which kind of happened, which one of the reasons why I don't use Facebook, that it's suddenly out there for grabs for any academic or any data processor to process it. So fine with that. But on the other hand, there exists a kind of public sphere, the public sphere that, for example, people like me working in critical discourse studies engage with. And then, you know, for example, a politician who makes a public statement as a politician in the public sphere, I mean, no way he could ever invoke data protection. And you know, but there we have to be explicit in when we formulate our public interest criterion, that when we try to formulate that the kind of research that we do is in the public interest, there we have to make sure that we kind of advocate the notion of public sphere as a public domain that one can critically engage with on basis of normal democratic debate. I mean, if we don't have that free space, then basically all democratic public debate within society is stifled. And that's something, a point that that I think in the context of GDPR we have to make quite explicitly.
Sorry, thank you. So this project is a project I was involved in called Common Cause, and it's about the relationship between universities and black and ethnic minority organizations. And one of the things that's been really helpful is to think about the ethics of that, of working with organizations. And I guess, and we were one of the case studies in the project. But I just wanted to highlight the report, which had some really good implications for the 10 principles. That's the one. 10 principles of community university partnerships, which I think are really helpful for this discussion. So we talked about a commitment to strengthening the partnering of the community organization, commitment to mutual benefit, transparency and accountability, fair payments, fair knowledge exchange, sustainability and legacy, inequality and diversity. And these things, I know we talked about this morning, but I think they also come into ethics. So to think, if you're working with an organization, even a school or whatever, what are you giving back? And how the ethical principles should link to these kind of principles. So that's really what I wanted to highlight. And I think that's really useful. I meant to talk about it this morning, but I forgot. Sorry. Anyway.
send it to us, then we can send it to the participants. Oh, did you? Oh, great. Okay, thanks. Do we have? Okay, we do.
Just something I've been thinking about from the perspective again of young researchers. I think we all agree that research ethics is about much more than legal requirements and formal guidelines, but it's a lot about, it requires that researchers engage in this reflective process of what they're doing and that they're also being open about it when they publish. So last week I attended a panel on research ethics with four senior researchers, and each of them had a story to tell about some terrible mistake they had made in the past, and it just, I felt like it was good to hear that, and at the same time I was very aware that the reason why they could talk about this openly was that each of them had, you know, a position as a senior researcher at a university. And so I think something I've been thinking about, I've been struggling with, is this kind of, especially for young researchers, you don't have the sort of credibility yet. You have to prove your credibility to the research community also by abiding by these ethical standards. And at the same time, even senior researchers admit that it is much less than clear-cut what that actually means. So I just find it difficult to balance this kind of openness between, you know, being open about what you don't know for sure, and maybe something, you know, you can't control and these kind of things, and at the same time still having to build your credibility as an you know, as a researcher in the field.
Well, that's why I went to the lawyer. I wanted advice, her advice on what to do, because I do stuff with sensitive, I work with sensitive stuff, from blog research. I've moved to theatre with people living in mental health conditions, and I do theatre with them. We publish on Facebook. We did a theatre festival. So I work with very sensitive issues. And if I was at this point without permanent jobs since 10 years, I was caught breaking the law. And then, because also it's also about how this GDPR has been communicated to us. We as researchers are a threat to the reputation of the university. And we might take the step that then pushes the university over the edge and makes it collapse as a credible research community. And of course that would then destroy my career. So this is how the ethical questions are turned to legal questions, because of fear of us being taken to court and being ruined on the level of the university, on the level of us researchers. And of course we don't want that, because we want to continue doing participatory research with vulnerable subjects whose voices we want to make heard. The end. Yeah, but this one point that links to what you were saying about the public sphere, because one of my worries, like outside the university, is what happens to public discourse if it cannot be critically addressed by researchers freely. What is public? This applies to blog writing, especially, where people may write anonymously, but they write to the public sphere. Make public statements, and especially from the point of view of people, for example, working with hate speech, this is extremely problematic. What happens to public discourse if you can't, if we as researchers cannot assess and critique what is being said in public in the internet?
Continuing on what I just said, that is why we have to formulate a notion of public sphere on the basis of the of the public interest criterion, just to safeguard basically democratic debate and keep that space open. That would be my. But okay, who's going to do that?
otherwise, we lose our voice. People lose voice.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Then GDPR will stifle democracy. Yep. And that can't be.
Thanks everybody for participating, and you know, these are great issues. They're nothing solved, but I think we have a better perspective, in at least a better understanding that it is more gray, and it's not. And I agree with what everybody said about it shouldn't just be about the legal part of it. It really should be about the ethical part, and we need to take back as researchers, if we can. But thanks everybody for participating, and there's coffee back there. So we'll have a coffee break, and then the Horizon people will take off. And I think we're making it. Oh, thank you.